In France, in the year 1398, it was recorded in a document called Chronique de Saint-Denis that, quote, at the end of November, for 8 successive nights, a comet could be seen in the sky, burning with extraordinary intensity, its tail turned toward the west. According to the astrologers, its appearance presaged the death of kings or the imminence of revolutions. Men of wisdom and experience, when they look back later at what happened, preferred to see it as the harbinger of revolutions. Unquote. Across the Channel in 1398, England was ruled by a king who was making his people nervous. We know this from evidence found in texts written at the time. A chronicler of this period, whose political sympathies were aligned to those of the king, wrote, quote, evil rumours began to spread because of the harsh bondage to which the whole community was being subjected, unquote. The more famous and illustrious writer, John Gower, who the king had earlier commissioned to write for him, also wrote that year that the people of England were suffering because of the wrongs that the king had committed. Gower said that instead of initiating purges and imposing censorship, the king should take to the road and go out and listen to his people, that he should let them speak openly, not suppress their complaints as he was doing. Another writer at the time created a document known as Richard the Redeless. According to him, Richard II had come to the throne with the goodwill of his people, but since then he had fallen under the influence of foolish counsellors who had led him to abuse the law, overtax his subjects and maltreat the commons. Another document, a satirical one called On the King's Ministers, written at this time, picked up on the theme of the foolishness of the king's counsellors and denounced their arrogance and bad advice, which was turning their king into a tyrant. There was a growing sense of discontent across England from amidst the poor, but no evidence exists to suggest that the king gave a crap about what his population thought. He showed no signs of being greatly concerned about his subjects' attitude, favourable or otherwise, towards him. What we see is a man who is on the whole disdainful of the opinions of the commons. He made little or no attempts to seek their goodwill or affection, and he showed himself indifferent to their aspirations. As he became more powerful in the 1390s, so he became more aloof, and possibly, probably, much more arrogant. He was only concerned about the opinions of the nobility. And as we covered last episode, he had suspected his former political enemies of plotting his downfall and had reacted fast by crushing them. In the aftermath of this victory, however, he seems to have retreated inwards and become much more self-absorbed. He was always introspective to a degree, but in the final 2 years of his reign, this tendency became more pronounced. He began to depend more and more upon ceremony and symbolism. It became his habit to sit enthroned from dinner until vespers, observed by his courtiers, who were expected to bend the knee whenever his gaze fell upon them. At the same time, the chroniclers tell how he was increasingly given to spending his time in the company of sycophants and cronies. Oh, and armed men. He was now always surrounded by hundreds of loyalists recruited from the north of England. The overwhelming impression we have of Richard II, the King of England, based on his actions, his movements and his decisions, was that after 1397, he was a man who was living increasingly in fear and paranoia towards the nobility of England. Though he was the supreme power in the realm, he seemed to distrust everyone but the closest of his courtly favourites. Far more than any king previous to him, he distanced himself from his subjects. Richard elevated himself above them and did everything in his power to impress upon them the duty of obedience to his royal state. If that didn't work, wherever he travelled, he surrounded himself with armed bodyguards who ate and slept with him and installed terror into every community through which they passed. This situation could not last forever. And London was to witness its resolution, its brutal, swift end, and had to respond bloody quickly to it. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is the story of London. a weekly podcast that tries to tell the history of the city in a chronological narrative. This week we examine the fall of King Richard II and how London tried their best and succeeded to a large extent in avoiding this until it was too late to avoid it. And then what did they do? Welcome then to chapter 143 of this story of London, Harbinger of Revolutions. Truth to say, though, unfortunately for our podcast, in the final couple of years of his rule, Richard II ignored London. He much preferred to lavish his attention upon Cheshire. There were reasons for this. The men of Cheshire had served his father, the Black Prince, for about 30 years. They were loyal to the man and now to his son. Richard rewarded that generosity with financial and political presents. He passed a law changing the status of the county to a principality in September 1397. The effect was to make Cheshire more important than the county palatinates of Lancaster and Durham, and to make it equal to the Principality of Wales. He also annexed lands of nobles who had crossed him and gave them to the county, briefly making it the largest in the kingdom. He offered the residents of Cheshire a bevy of other gifts: pardons, royal offices, grants of lands, and confiscated goods. The city of Chester had its privileges extended. Cheshire, in effect, became the inner citadel of his kingdom. It was the county in which he found security, an acceptance he found nowhere else, and it was from here he began to now recruit new retainers and servants. Before the end of 1397, King Richard was surrounded by men who had been recruited from basically every part of his kingdom. After 1397, almost all of them came from the northwest of England, and Cheshire especially. 11 of the 28 new knights retained in the last 2 years of his reign came from Cheshire or Lancashire. But no fewer than 140 of the 170 or so esquires he recruited came from that region. By September 1398, the total number of men from Cheshire in the king's pay came to around 760. The core of the group was the famous bodyguard, which comprised of 311 archers. These men divided themselves up into seven watches, allowing them to provide 24 hours a day protection for the king, like some northern Praetorian. In addition to this elite group, there was also a reserve bodyguard of 101 archers who were retained for life, and a further 197 who were retained whenever the king decided to increase the numbers. Never before had a king surrounded himself by so massive a personal bodyguard. The closest we ever saw were the likes of Arthur Canute way back then. Yes, sure, the likes of Edward I and his successors had kept a body of king's archers or archers of the crown, but never this many. This force gave all the impression of being a private army for the king. It was the task of the members to protect the king by day and by night, but it was to provide the king with a barrier between his kingdom and himself, a personal northern fortress of men between Richard and any threats he would face. The irony of his reign was the threat that brought him down was an argument that broke out within that circle of protection. It started with a fight between two men of his inner court. Thomas Mowbray, who had been newly created the Duke of Norfolk, and the king's cousin and the son of John of Gaunt, Henry Bolingbroke, who had just been created the Duke of Hereford. Now, the cause and progress of this row has been the source of ongoing and varied historical debate. And it does not help that, alas, we only ever really get to hear Bolingbroke's point of view on the matter. But, interestingly enough for us, his version of the start of this argument begins on the road to London. The story goes that Bolingbroke had been riding between Brentford and London one day in December 1397, when Mowbray, the Duke of Norfolk, sought him out, riding up and catching up with him at great speed. Mowbray informed Henry that they were about to be, quote, undone, unquote, by the king for their part in the events we covered back in 1387 and 1388, when they were part of the Lords Appellant. Bolingbroke simply dismissed the idea, reminding Mowbray that they'd both been pardoned for their involvement in that. His new companion insisted that the pardons were worthless. The claim is, in response to this allegation, that Henry of Bolingbroke, there on the road to London, is said to have replied, with his most famous of all remarks, that, quote, it was a funny old world, unquote. Mowbray went on to allege, at least according to Henry, that, quote, had it not been for certain people, your father, the Lord of Lancaster, and you would have been either seized or killed when you came to Windsor, unquote. This referred to a recent parliament in September 1397. The Duke of Norfolk went on to allege a vast conspiracy within the King's court who was seeking to try to take out John of Gaunt and his son, and that this conspiracy was being led by the King himself. Now, the allegation itself may have been total bullshit, I suppose, we'll never know, but crucially it does seem that at this moment, the conspiracy, if there was one, was focused not so much on Henry of Bolingbroke, but upon his ageing father, the Duke of Lancaster, John of Gaunt. And the potential reason for this was that going on right now was the first hints of a discussion about that most awkward of subjects, succession. By 1397, the king was only 30 years old. He'd been married to Queen Anne of Bohemia, but had not produced any children. And there wasn't going to be any children in the offing for some time, given the fact that his new queen, Isabella of France, was 7 or 8 years old. Now, by tradition, if not by law, the throne of England descended by primogeniture. And if tradition were followed, and Richard were to remain childless, and something were to happen to the king, then the heir would have been the young Earl of March, Roger Mortimer. Yes, I said Mortimer. The Mortimer dynasty, which had seen another Roger Mortimer, the first Earl of March, become the lover of the English Queen, which I covered all the way back in chapter 117 of the story, the one about the she-wolf, and then eventually get mutilated by her son, Edward I, as we covered back in chapter 118 of the story. Yeah, that dynasty was back, and with a vengeance. See, the dynasty had survived, and the third Earl of March had married Philippa, the daughter of Prince Lionel, aka the Duke of Clarence, aka the son of Edward III. And those descended from Lionel would have a higher place in the line of succession over those descended from the younger sons of King Edward III. And just so everybody's on the same page, while we are quite a few years away from the conflict that will be known as the War of the Roses, we do need to understand that right here and right now is where we are planting the seeds of those rose bushes. So here in 1397, the line of succession went as follows. King Edward III had been King of England, and he was dead. His oldest son, the Black Prince, had died also, but he had one son, Richard, who is now King. The next eldest son of Edward III was Lionel, and he had one grandson, Roger Mortimer, who was next in line. The next son of Edward III was John of Gaunt, who'd become the Duke of Lancaster, and he was still alive, and that meant he was next after Roger Mortimer, and after him would come his son, Henry Bolingbroke. And then the next eldest surviving son of Edward III was Edmund the Duke of York, and he had a bunch of kids who would come after Bolingbroke. And then after them would come the king's youngest son, Thomas the Duke of Gloucester, and he'd been killed, but he had a young son called Humphrey. Got it? Keep that in mind, we will come back to it. But with that in mind, let's get back to 1397 and 1398. Richard II is 30 and has no children. And the next in line is Roger Mortimer, who's off in Ireland, literally spending all his time in Ireland as ruling Ireland on behalf of the Crown really does seem to have been his thing, and it appears that he was trying to avoid all the political shenanigans taking place over in England. But that accusation Henry of Bolingbroke had received, that there was a conspiracy against his father, would partly be tied into the dynasty and the line of succession, and also be partly tied into the fact that the Duke of Lancaster was also insanely rich. John of Gaunt aroused jealousy because of his staggering wealth. The Lancasterian inheritance was by far the largest in England, worth at least £12,000 a year. That's roughly $8.5+ million by today's money. There were strong undercurrents of politics going on around the high nobility of England right now. And it appears, and I'm simplifying this matter to a criminal degree of negligence here for the sake of a story, please note, that the Duke of Norfolk may well have been telling the truth about there being a plot against the Duke of Lancaster being led by the King. And he may have known about it because he'd been part of it. And he may right now be trying to be very clever and trying to play both sides. We do not know for sure. Whatever the case, however, Norfolk was, whichever way you look at it, pissing about, and Henry of Bolingbroke was having none of it. Bolingbroke now had a free hand to present his side of the story, and so he did so in full Parliament at Shrewsbury. King Richard reacted in a way that strongly implied his belief in Norfolk's guilt, and the Duke of Norfolk was stripped of his offices of Earl Marshal and Admiral of England, and was ordered to be apprehended. And London now found itself being given a front row seat, as it was decided that he would be imprisoned in the Great Wardrobe of London. Yes, the place where young Richard II had sheltered during the Peasants' Revolt was now to become the prison of the Duke of Norfolk. On the 23rd of February, 1398, the Duke was brought before the King. He denied everything that Henry Bolingbroke had alleged against him. The King, in consequence, ordered the two men to appear before a parliamentary committee. They'd decide who was telling the truth. Unfortunately, they did not decide who was telling the truth. They couldn't actually tell. And by now, Henry Bolingbroke had escalated the allegations to accuse Norfolk of a heap of other things, including being personally behind the murder of the Duke of Gloucester. And because of all of this, it was decided that the two men should don armour and beat the shit out of one another up in Coventry. Whoever won the fight, they were telling the truth. Simple. What was organised to take place in Gosford, a small village just outside of Coventry, was going to become one of the high points of chivalry in this decade, if not in this entire medieval era. The Duke of Norfolk fighting the Duke of Hereford in a gigantic display of noble privilege. A measure of how big a deal it was that centuries later became a pivotal moment in Shakespeare's account of these events of the time. However, for the King, he didn't want this situation to actually happen. See, if Mowbray won, because Henry had raised the issue of the sudden death of the King's uncle, the Duke of Gloucester, over in Calais again, it would leave a hint that the King was hiding details of the murder under a mattress. Meanwhile, if Bolingbroke won, it would add even more glory and prestige to his cousin. And Richard probably was at this date rather nervous about how much glory and prestige Bolingbroke seemed to be carrying. Also, well, Henry had raised the issue of the death of the Duke of Gloucester as it was his uncle also. And overall, the King was not happy. Still, what began did appear that it was going to be one hell of a show. Henry arrived at the specially constructed lists at 9 a.m, accompanied by 6 mounted attendants. When he was formally challenged by the constable, the marshal, as to his name and business, he said he was Henry, Duke of Hereford, come to do his duty against the false traitor Thomas, Duke of Norfolk. He then took an oath to uphold his claim, crossed himself, and rode to a pavilion at the far end of the lists. Immediately after this, the King arrived, along with his archers from Cheshire, in full force. Soon after the King was seated, the Duke of Norfolk arrived. He took the same oath as Bolingbroke, and then cried out, "Godspeed the right," and rode over to his pavilion. The two men's lances were then measured. After this, the champions' tents were removed. Bolingbroke made the first advances towards his opponent, but the Duke of Norfolk remained motionless, his horse steady. And then, suddenly, the King stood up and cried, "Hold!" and the proceedings were immediately halted. Aww. The crowd was a bit disappointed, and so they waited for 2 hours. And then Sir John Bushy came out to announce the king's decision. The Duke of Norfolk was to be exiled from England for life because of the allegations against him. But, in the name of fairness, Henry Bolingbroke, the Duke of Hereford, was also to be banished from England for the duration of 10 years. Now, this news was immediately followed by a huge outcry. Bolingbroke, as we've hinted, was popular. But with a whole bunch of Cheshire archers stood watching and intimidating, the outcry soon shut up. The king then made the two rivals swear to abide by his judgment, and shortly thereafter, he pissed off. Now, regardless of the rights and wrongs of what the king did, there can be little doubt that the events in Coventry could be seen, especially by him, as the zenith of his power, the height of his success. I mean, think about it. The group of five nobles who had humiliated him years before, the Lords Appellant, had now all been dealt with. Gloucester and Arundel were dead. Warwick was rotting in a prison in the Isle of Man, and Hereford and Norfolk had now been condemned to exile. Meanwhile, while this is going on, financially, surprise, surprise, the king was financially secure. Between the massive dowry he gained from marrying a young French princess and the monies he was now confiscating from the former Lord Appellant, he'd managed to replenish his coffers wonderfully. Meanwhile, at the same time, Parliament was showing itself to be agreeably compliant to any of his demands, and the nobles were nervous and being loyal, bowing when his eyes fell upon them. He was reshaping political society in England as he wished. It is arguable that right now, Richard II was, in terms of political control over England, the most powerful of the monarchs of this land, running the most all-encompassing of regimes. Certainly, he had more control of anyone since William I. But there were dark clouds on the horizon, and one of them was news from Ireland. Roger Mortimer, technically the next in line for the throne, was dead, killed in a skirmish during some insurrection over there, which meant, technically speaking, John of Gaunt was next in line for the throne. Ah, and the king had just, you know, exiled his son for a decade. But then again, Richard did not fear John of Gaunt turning against him. After all, the Duke of Lancaster had supported him after his return from his failed campaign in Castilia, and had thus brought great stability to the king's rule all through the 1390s. Towards the end of 1398, it's clear Richard wasn't overtly worried about this situation. In the wake of the events in Coventry, he issued decrees saying Henry Bolingbroke was of course the heir to his father's land, and even in exile, if God forbid anything were to happen to his aged uncle, his son would inherit the duchy. Richard at this point probably did expect John of Gaunt to survive and to be reasonably active for some years to come. I mean, he'd stayed with him at Leicester in that September, and at that time, apparently, John of Gaunt was still in good health. But early in the new year of 1399, however, old John of Gaunt was suddenly struck ill, and on the 3rd of February, he died. A decision had to be made quickly on whether or not Henry Bolingbroke should be allowed to inherit the Duchy of Lancaster. I mean, you know, to refuse him would be to commit an act flagrantly at odds with the law, and it would be deeply scary to a political class of men with swords who owned land. But on the other hand, to accept it would mean that the guy he just pissed off by exiling for a decade would now become the Duke of Lancaster and the most important noble in England. This was a bit awkward. Mind you, if you consider just how much fricking money the estate was worth. Yeah, on March 18th, 6 weeks after the Duke of Lancaster's death, the king revoked the letters he had granted in the previous October, and at the same time he caused the terms of reference to a parliamentary committee to be altered to allow a sentence of perpetual banishment be imposed on Henry Bolingbroke. The Duchy of Lancaster was his. Meanwhile, according to the French document we quoted at the start of this episode, quote, Having left England, Henry went to France, where he was counting on a warm welcome from the king and the princes of the fleur-de-lis, unquote. You got to understand, the marriage of King Richard to the 7-year-old princess of France had actually apparently initiated a 30-year truce in the ongoing war between England and France, but forces on both sides of the Channel were opposed to this truce, and it was in this atmosphere that Henry of Bolingbroke arrived in France. Quote, "He was indeed received by them with respect due to a favoured kinsman. For as long as he remained in the kingdom, the king accommodated not only him but all his followers in royal residences, entertained them and plied them with gifts. The King of England, annoyed that so much respect was being shown to them, wrote to his beloved father-in-law, the King of France, and to his dear cousins, the Dukes, explaining that he had exiled from his realm several persons guilty of treason, and requesting them not to show too much favour to these traitors, nor offer them any support," unquote. This sudden description of Bolingbroke as a traitor was clearly an escalation in language, and according to the French, quote, "was but one example of the implacable hatred which he felt towards Henry," unquote. The seizure of the Duchy of Lancaster had caused Henry of Bolingbroke to respond angrily, and, quote, "the young Duke, at the limits of his patience, complained to the King and Princes of France about the cruelty of such a deed, accusing King Richard of perjury, and declaring that he knew not what to do, nor what course of action to take. Meanwhile, he had already begun to think in terms of hostile action against the English King and his kingdom," unquote. It's at this point Henry, however, entered French politics, and French politics began dictating in response to him. The King's uncle, the Duke of Berry, began to sympathise with Bolingbroke, and, quote, "he told him, brave souls do not allow themselves to be downhearted by reversals of fortune, but resign themselves for waiting for better times. He advised him not to eschew any dishonourable action that might sully the reputation bequeathed to him by so great a prince as his father. Henry thanked the Duke of Berry for these words of consolation. He feigned indifference and pretended to be cheerful. This, however, was but one of those ruses which were familiar to the English, the way of concealing more effectively the plan which he had to avenge his injuries," unquote. Ultimately, even though Henry was acting, "oh yeah, I'm fine, while plotting to get revenge, Richard II was not too overtly worried about Henry being in France. See, the King of England's most powerful ally in the French court was Philip of Burgundy, who was effectively the head of the French government at the time. Burgundy's political interests lay in maintaining good and peaceful relations with England, so he supported the truce. And he did this because the cloth industry in his county of Flanders was dependent on a steady supply of English wool. In order to demonstrate goodwill to the English king, he agreed to keep an eye on Bolingbroke. So long as Burgundy was in control in the French government, Richard could be confident that his interests would be properly safeguarded. In 1399, however, the Duke of Burgundy was increasingly threatened by his nephew and rival, Louis, Duke of Orléans. Now, Duke Louis's political objectives were way different from the Duke of Burgundy. He had this idea of carving a personal empire for himself in central Italy from the church states, and this was something the English opposed. And at the same time, he also had ideas of establishing control over the county of Perigord, which is west of his lands in France, but that area lay on the borders of the English-held Aquitaine, and the English objected to that also. So for Duke Louis, a truce and peace with England did not serve his personal interests. By early 1399, it was clear to the Duke that he needed to end the Anglo-French rapprochement if he was to advance his own ambitions. So it should come as no big surprise that by the late spring of that year, he entered into negotiations with Henry Bolingbroke. And on the 17th of June, the two men entered into a treaty of friendship. Now, the terms of the treaty seemed innocent enough. The dukes swore to be each other's friends and well-wishers and to maintain each other's honour, estate and well-being. Reading to between the lines, it was clear that the Englishman had told the Frenchman what he was planning. Bolingbroke was going to return to England. He intended to invade. Now, I've got to say, at this stage, it is highly unlikely that he was planning to take the throne. He was just going back to reclaim his inheritance. But the Duke of Orleans, whether or not he fully trusted the Englishman to keep his word, ultimately just gave him his blessing and helped get other leading figures in France, including the king, to not stand in Bolingbroke's way. And it didn't help King Richard, that back in England, Richard had decided that the insurrection that had killed Roger Mortimer now needed dealing with. So he was going to sail to Ireland with an army to crush it. But at the same time he did this, he dismissed many of his young queen's staff, reducing her to having only a handful at best, and isolating the young girl. This move upset many of the French nobility and royalty back here in France. Orléans was able to exploit this, and now very peeved at the treatment of his daughter, the King of France made no move whatsoever to prevent Henry of Bolingbroke from sailing home. With news of Richard's departure to Ireland now known to him, Henry began his plans in earnest. He gathered together a small retinue of Lancasterian exiles and others, including the Bishop of Arundel, and he made his way to Boulogne, putting it about that he was just embarking on a pilgrimage somewhere. Now, his sympathisers over in England arranged for a, quote, sizeable fleet, unquote, to cross the Channel to pick him up. But this alarmed the Duke of Burgundy, who was very surprised to see so much English shipping just turn up in Boulogne one morning. He ordered the town to go on alert, but Henry was able to avoid any precautions and get himself and a body of men-at-arms on board the ships and set sail for England. The authorities back in England, led by the Duke of York, since the King was now in Ireland with a large army, they were very aware of what Bolingbroke was up to, and they issued an alert that an invasion of the south of England was imminent. But Henry, after some prevarication and clear indecision, did finally decide to sail up the east coast and land on the Humber estuary. In Yorkshire, the Duke would be sure of receiving a sympathetic reception, as his family had many estates up there. And after heading to Pickering to cover his flank and then turning westward to Knaresborough and Pontefract, he marched into England. And he probably had about 60 followers to begin with. As he made his way slowly across Yorkshire, however, his numbers swelled. The duchy accounts record that some 37 knights and esquires came to him with their companies and attendants. And when he reached Doncaster, he won the backing of the Earl of Northumberland and his son, Henry Hotspur. The terms on which these two lords committed themselves to his cause aren't entirely clear, but they said they would support the Duke in his endeavour to recover his ancestral estates. This defection gave Henry a considerable psychological boost. On the 4th of July, the Duke of York sent a message to Richard and Ireland to inform him of Duke Henry's landing. However, it was nearly a fortnight before the King could undertake a return journey to Wales. One source at the time says that, quote, just when everything was ready, Richard ordered that the horses and provisions, which had already been loaded onto the boats, be unloaded again and taken to a different port. As a result of this, it was another 7 days before the horses and the other apparatus could be once more assembled on board ship, unquote. Now, the problem Richard II was confronting was the same problem Henry II had faced when he was the first King of England to invade Ireland. It's one thing to sail a large army across the Irish Sea, but unless you had your shipping sorted out, it was another thing to then return with your large army. Henry II had intelligently kept ships in his employ the entire time he was in Ireland, so he could leave, as we explored all the way back in chapter 72. Richard II had not done this. When the Royal Army had disembarked in Waterford that June, most of the vessels had been dispersed. Some had gone on to Dublin, others had been sent back to England. Richard was trapped in Ireland until he could get enough ships together. So he sent a small force in advance to raise his loyal subjects in Wales and then to secure Chester. But without the king being there in person, the Welsh, fearing he was dead and they'd be marching to folly, refused to muster and went home. With this failure of recruitment, with Richard stuck in Ireland, Henry began making his way across the Midlands, reaching his manor in Leicester around the 20th of July in 1399. Here he paused briefly. What to do next? He could carry on southwards to London to take the capital, or head southwest to Bristol to cut off Richard's return, or he could occupy Chester, the king's inner citadel. Initially, he does appear to have intended to head towards London, but on the 20th of July, the Duke of York, Keeper of England at this moment, began moving slowly to the west in the hope of linking up with King Richard, and Henry decided to intercept him. Making his way through Coventry, Warwick and Evesham, he reached Gloucester around about the 26th of July, and on the 27th he caught up with the Duke of York at Berkeley. In Berkeley Parish Church, the two men had a meeting, and they came to an agreement, whose terms we do not know the full details on, but the essence was clear. The Duke of York surrendered to Henry Bolingbroke. Precisely why York gave in so easily is hard to say, but it seems to have been an unwillingness to stand in the way of one of the high nobility simply coming to reclaim his inheritance. And that was what this was even now. Henry just wished to claim the stolen Duchy of Lancaster. Nothing more. Whatever the justification of York's actions, the meeting at Berkeley was a turning point in Bolingbroke's campaign. From this time on, Henry and the Duke of York were to act in unison. They ignored London and swung southwest, aiming for Bristol, which fell without a fight and saw three of the king's councillors captured, hung and beheaded. Within barely a month of his landing, Henry Bolingbroke had won control over most of central and eastern England. Richard's delay in returning had been the cause of a huge hemorrhaging of his support across the entire country. Many of his backers believed that he either died or had fled, and retainers who would have fought for him simply laid down their arms. By the time that King Richard finally landed in South Wales, around about the 24th of July, he was in a terribly weak position, and he decided to head north with a small group, aiming for the castle of Harlech and then onto the castles of the North Welsh coast. This journey, a distance of nearly 200 miles across difficult country, must have taken about 9 or 10 days. All the while, the king's movements have been shadowed by those of Bolingbroke, moving up from Bristol along the Welsh border. Eventually, he arrived at Chester, and this great inner citadel of King Richard surrendered without a fight. Eventually, on the North Welsh coast, the two men's forces caught up with one another. King Richard had been outmaneuvered and outplayed. We do not know what fully was said in negotiations in Conway Castle, but we do know that the rule of Richard II was now effectively over. He was taken to Chester and held in a cell. Henry of Bolingbroke was effectively the ruler of England. With the capture of the king, political power had changed. And down in London, the city had successfully managed to avoid this entire mess. The mayor who'd replaced Richard Whittington was a man called Drugo Barrington, whose name's often translated as Drew Barrington. Drugo was of an Anglo-Norman family, and he currently was a successful goldsmith. Back in 93, he had served as a sheriff of London alongside Richard Whittington. So it should maybe not come as much of a surprise that he'd been Richard Whittington's successor as mayor of London. Because of King Richard II's patronage of the likes of Dick Whittington and others, London had not gone over to show support for Bolingbroke so far. Although, truth being said, they were certainly not reverting to the old trope of being a royalist bastion for the king. London had watched and basically kept out of this entire mess up until right now. Richard II had been captured and Henry of Bolingbroke was clearly the man with all the power. The records of the time are very clear on what happened right now and the choice made by Mayor Drugo Barrington. Quote, while the Duke was then at Chester, three of the 24 aldermen of the City of London, on behalf of the same city, together with 50 other citizens, came to the Duke and recommended their city to him, under their common seal, renouncing their fealty to King Richard. They told, too, how the citizens had gathered in arms in Westminster Abbey to search for the king, hearing he had in secret fled thither. and that, not finding him there, they had ordered to be kept in custody till Parliament, Roger Walden, Nicholas Slake and Ralph Selby, the King's special counsellors, whom they did find, unquote. It's interesting, the story this tells. While we focus on the actions of great kings and lords, here we have an image of London. Bolingbroke is marching across the kingdom. The king was last seen in Ireland, rumour abounded he was dead. And some little Londoner says to his mate, you know what, he could be hiding out in Westminster. That's his home, innit? Bet you he's hiding out. Let's get some lads and go find him. In truth, whether Londoners had done it that way, or when news arrived from North Wales, they just decided to say this is what they were doing. The truth was the mayor had spotted which way the political wind was blowing. And so he, three aldermen and 50 others, rode to Chester, bent the knee to Henry of Bolingbroke and his new regime. The account goes on to say that Bolingbroke, quote, having gloriously, within 50 days, conquered both king and kingdom, marched to London, and there he placed the captive king in the Tower under fitting guard, unquote. The final dance of this sudden revolution now began. I could speak for ages as to the complex nature of the actual processes of the disposition of the king of his title and the intricate legal precedents Henry had to dance over. But in essence, here in London, in the White Tower and over in Westminster, the location of so much of the city's drama, this revolution came full circle. Richard II, the last of the main line of Plantagenet kings who had ruled unbroken since the reign of Henry II, was deposed. In his place, Henry of Bolingbroke, from this new minor branch of the dynasty, the Lancasterian one, usurped the throne and placed himself upon it, becoming King of England. London would have witnessed a delicious irony in this. See, Richard II had just spent a fortune rebuilding and improving Westminster Palace and the Great Hall, and it had not been used in years in order to complete its refitting. And yet, now it was finally ready to be used. The first gathering within it was for his disposition. Here, before an empty throne, the commons heard the resignation of King Richard and the claim to the throne by Henry, son of the Duke of Lancaster, on the grounds of right of descent of Henry III and of the misgovernment of Richard. Perhaps very wisely, the throne was not claimed through right of conquest. A week later, the Parliament met there again, and at this meeting, Henry was king. The coronation took place at the Abbey across the road on the 13th of October, and the banquet that followed in the hall was an incredibly lavish affair. Guests enjoyed pheasant, peacock, boar's head, cranes, herons, stuffed pigs, venison, and apparently there were 9 fountains that sprouted red and white wine. The hall that Richard rebuilt, by the way, is still with us. The old roof, put up during the reign of William II, had been torn down, and under the supervision of Henry of Airlie and his master carpenter Hugh Herland, the walls were raised and buttressed, and a magnificent hammerbeam roof which spanned the hall was erected, weighing 660 tons. That's the one that apparently still stands to this day. King Henry now began his reign adorned in the trappings and splendour of his predecessor. As for Richard, well, after a small rebellion in his name, the king was sent to a northern castle, and there, most probably, he was allowed to starve to death. A wretched, broken figure, his fall had come quickly. Richard II had been king during medieval London's most intense period of political conflict. It had been on his watch that the great saga of the Jubilee had happened, and then afterwards, he had destroyed the entire political status quo of London with his brutal clampdown on the city, and then got on to be the king who had given London Richard Whittington. He will always be, for good or for bad, one of London's most significant kings, a role enhanced by the fact that his handiwork is seen in Westminster Palace to this day. While his legacy as a national figure is open to debate, from the City of London's point of view, he stands arguably as the most impactful king upon this city since King Stephen during the anarchy. Now, he was gone. His fall heralded by an ill-omened comet which had streaked across the sky and the harbinger of revolution had been proven to be true. And London awoke in the year 1400 on some fine January morning to find that upon the throne sat Henry, fourth of his name, King of England, Lord of the City. And the game had entirely changed. But while the game had changed, it still carried on. We have reached the 15th century, and London is about to enter a whole new era. And if you thought the last century was wild, hang on, folks. And I'm going to end that chapter there. Thanks for listening. I want to thank all the people who have sent me comments and wonderful reviews and wonderful messages on the Buy Me a Coffee website. It really is appreciated, any and all contact. Hope you enjoyed that. Ah, alas, Richard II. I'll be back next week for another chapter here in the story of London. Thank you so much for listening. This is Saul saying, have a great week. Bye.